So I go to dental school, I get my degree, I become a dentist, I practice, and then I pretty much do the same thing for 30, 40 years, and then I retire, and that's my life. That just seemed really bleak. So my name is Jordan App Wilson. I'm an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. I actually just got my bachelor degree in molecular cellular biology and plant sciences, and then a minor in biochemistry. And I'm a Norman Borlaug scholar, so it feels good to be here.
Yeah, well, that's why we're here in Pine Mountain, Georgia for the 2019 meeting of the National Association of Plant Breeders. Congrats on being a Borlaug scholar. Jordan, what's one little known fact about you that people often don't know?
So let's see, a little known fact. I actually did an interview for a newsletter at my university, and I was the focus of like one of the weekly editions, and they asked me the same question. And I think a little known fact that a lot of people don't know about me is that I'm 26, I'm turning 27. I actually took about 3 years off from college. And so I went into the U of A right after high school. I've been born and raised in Tucson. And I was there at the U of A when I was like 18 for about a year. And I was in, I was taking a final, I think. It was for God and the Soul. It was like a, you know, entry level psych class. And I was taking the final, and I was looking down at the paper, and I knew the answers. It's not like I didn't know any of the material, but I looked down at the paper, and I thought to myself, wow, I would rather do literally anything else than be here right now. I had no idea what I wanted to do in life. I thought I wanted to be a dentist. I felt so just kind of disillusioned with education in general that during the middle of the final, I got up and I got my final and I walked out. And as I walked out, I threw my final away. So I crumpled it up and I threw it away. And at the time, I had my car that I still had from high school. It was a 1981 VW Vanagon, nice cream banana color. And I got in it and I drove until I pretty much hit empty. So I ended up somewhere in Utah, I think. And I just kind of had like a little moment where, you know, I spent like a couple days out there trying to figure things out. And then I remembered I still have to pay rent. So I drove back home and, you know, I went to work and all that. But I took about 3 years off. I traveled a lot. I've been down to Mexico City. I've been across the U.S. I've been up into Canada. I think why I really found my passion to go back into education was I took this trip to Japan, and I actually got to see some like rural farming communities and work with some people in rural agriculture, mainly rice farming. And it was the exact opposite of how I felt in that physics or in that psychology final that day. It was, whereas then I felt disillusioned, during that time while I was working with those local farmers, I felt completely illusioned, I guess. So that's why I came back, and I wanted to do plant breeding, and I'm looking at rice. So,
well, you might have made more money as a dentist, though.
Yeah, I think I might have, but I think the thought of just being in someone's mouth all day, not even that. I think what really killed it for me was the thought of, so I go to dental school, I get my degree, I become a dentist, I practice, and then I pretty much do the same thing for 30, 40 years, and then I retire, and that's my life. That just seemed really bleak. I don't know. I think it hit me then. I was like, oh, wow, I really don't want to do that. Great profession, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But great people.
There's something to be said for plant breeding. And yeah, like you say, you work with rice now?
That's my future goal. That's really my passion. Right now I work with cotton and sorghum. Yeah.
What are you looking at right now in terms of cotton and sorghum? What does that work look like, and how is it making a difference?
At the University of Arizona, I'm working with a professor named Duke Pauli over there, and he works over at the Maricopa Agricultural Center, the MAC as we call it. And yeah, pretty much a lot of the work they do over there has to do with looking at drought tolerance in plants. Arizona, pretty good place to do that. I think just a few weeks ago, we're in the field harvesting some sorghum, and I think it hit like 113, 115. So yeah, it was, if you're looking at how to keep something from dying of heat, it's a good place. Specifically, I'll tell you a little bit about our work in cotton. We're looking at, of course, drought resistance. A main way we're trying to go about that is looking at kind of the leaf architecture of cotton and trying to make a more hospitable microenvironment to kind of trap some of that moisture in there and not lose so much via transpiration. So in cotton, the leaves can kind of vary in leaf shape. Usually they're regular, which is like a nice big full leaf, or they can be sub-okra, okra, or super okra, which is just ways to define how thin the leaf gets. So a super okra, it's like pretty thin leaf. And then okra, you know, a little broader, until eventually regular. And then normally in cotton, all the leaves are regular. You know, they're nice kind of like fatty, kind of heart-shaped leaves almost. So as the plant grows, it will drop the lower leaves because they're not getting enough sunlight as the canopy grows. So it drops the lower leaves, and that creates a less hospitable microenvironment where it loses more transpiration. So what we're trying to do is, first off, we're trying to kind of create like a line of cotton that as the plant matures and grows up, the leaves become increasingly more okra. So they start out regular, and then they become sub-okra, okra, and super-okra as the plant continues to grow. This way, the plant won't be dropping those lower canopy of leaves, which kind of creates a more hospitable microenvironment to kind of help keep that moisture and humidity kind of centered around the plant, instead of dropping those lower leaves and leaving it open to more kind of, like wind transpiration and stuff like that. So that's just some of the work we're doing. We're also looking at better use of water allocation. We're trying to look at the transcriptomics of the plants and make sure that certain responses that are being activated in response to drought. We're trying to look at lines that either have a quicker response or are more adapted to fluctuations, whether it's, you know, drought and then water and then drought again. You know, some plants have trouble dealing with a quick back and forth. Those are other aspects we're trying to look at as well.
Before our interview, I asked you what a common question you get from people is, and you said that people often ask you if you want to be a farmer.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you explain to them the difference between farming and plant breeding? What do you generally say to try and educate them a little bit about your profession?
It's usually a question I get from my family. My family is a lot of blue-collar people. You know, my dad was a miner. My tata was a miner. I have a lot of family that work in agriculture, especially since being Latino on my mom's side. A lot of family, of course, like my tata and everyone. You know, I think they came over and they worked in Sacramento and they worked in, like, on the vineyards a lot. And it was kind of hard to explain to them that I was going back into agriculture. I think a lot of them were like, they're a little shocked. They were like, yeah, we worked hard. Why are you going back into agriculture? And they're like, what, you're just going to be a farmer now? But I think a lot of people kind of miss, especially people who maybe haven't had the opportunity to be educated kind of in like a science field or something like that. When you tell them that you're going to be working with plants, I think the knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, agriculture, you're working with plants, you're just a farmer. Which, in a way, you almost are. You're working in close association with farmers, you're working in close association with, you know, the plants you're growing, the agriculture. I try to explain to them that it's like farming, but with a more keen sense of trying to get the cream of the crop, you know, and especially trying to explain the molecular biology behind it too, that might get kind of lost. So it's always kind of interesting trying to trying to talk to my family about it. Usually they're just content asking me about evolution and climate change. So I'm like their science link, I guess. If they have any kind of scientific hotspot question, I'm the go-to, apparently.
Well, and speaking of climate change, plant breeding is really essential to the future of humanity as we look at things like climate change, etc.
Oh, yeah.
Do breeders have the support they need to adequately address some of these challenges? And how do you, as a breeder, even begin to address something like climate change?
Between the NAPB and NEPA and NIH, there's a lot of opportunities. There's a lot of grants. I think there is allocations available for plant breeders. Do I think that that's enough? I don't know if it's entirely enough. I think that a lot of that support, especially in response to climate change, should be coming from a more, how would you say, executive federal level. And I think currently, you know, I don't want to get too political or anything, but I think currently, I don't know if there is the right interest in trying to combat climate change at the moment, at least in at the executive level. I think that just looking at, you know, the talks about climate change right now, the G7 summit, I mean, you know, it's a huge issue. It's a world issue. And I don't think it's something that can just be played around anymore. It's something that's kind of on the back burner, like, oh, yeah, it's happening, you know, we'll deal with it eventually. I think it's something that needs to be immediately addressed now. I think that without immediate action, it will be, I don't want to be too overboard, but probably catastrophic for future generations. So I think there are people trying really hard. I think there are resources available. I think that eventually support from the federal government will be paramount in making a physical larger change. I think people are trying their hardest right now, and it's, you know, it's going to make, they'll make a substantial change, but if you want to see a big radical shift, especially towards better allocation of resources, better use of water, looking at, you know, trying to combat climate change with focusing on plants that are drought, you know, drought tolerant, that can be grown in high salinity, or it can be grown in poorer fields, those kind of measures need to be taken by the federal government too. And there are resources being allocated, but I think there should be more. My hot take.
Well, and it's a complicated issue. It's not easy to solve, but one of the themes of this conference is solving some of these big issues or trying to solve them. And a lot of people here putting their heads together. And you are a Borlaug Scholar this year. Again, congratulations.
Thank you.
How does being a Borlaug Scholar and coming to Pine Mountain, Georgia, for the NAPB conference, how does that help you to further your work and to help in essentially making it a better world through plant breeding?
So I think in my application that I sent off for this award, I think I cited one of the biggest ways I think that plant breeding is changing and how plant breeding will change the world is that as we become more of kind of like a global society and how science starts reaching more and more people, I think that it's going to fall on a larger, more collaborative effort of scientists to kind of make this impact. And I think that collaboration is truly going to be the way forward. I don't think that the change in the world, you know, to help feed billions of people is going to come from, you know, just one man or one discovery or, you know, just one person out there. You know, it's going to come from small incremental changes from a number of people across the world making multiple discoveries. So I think collaboration is going to be the key forward. And I think that this event in particular helps me a great deal because, you know, a big part of collaboration is just knowing people. It's knowing people, it's becoming friends with people, exchanging ideas, you know, hoping to build a great working relationship moving forward. And I think that's why events like these are so kind of critical for the community. I think to get everyone together, to kind of help exchange ideas, to get people who you know, without events like these, might not even come in contact with each other. I think that these kind of meeting grounds help breed critical thinking and help breed growth in relationships, which I think is what the scientific community is not what it's missing, but what it should be focusing on moving forward. I think it's kind of collaborative efforts, building these connections, building these relationships, and helping to inspire more critical, more kind of out-of-the-box thinking, I guess, to be cliche about it. But I think that's what this event's doing for me, too. I've already met so many people that, you know, how would I have met them otherwise? People from Texas A&M, people from Cornell, people from NC State, people from Canada. You know, I would have never had a way to connect with these people outside of this event. So I am entirely and completely grateful.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it's been a great opportunity. Thank you so much.